It's true. Across the globe, women aren't as prosperous as men. Gender inequality is a pressing moral issue, but we forget it has massive economic implications. If you were to put all of the women who don't have access to formal financial services in one place, they would make up the third largest country in the world. That means an entire population without bank accounts, credit cards, or other tools you and I likely benefit from daily. Prosperity for women starts with inclusive policies, products, and people around the globe, and the investment to make it happen. Welcome to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast. My name is Sonia Kelly, and I lead Women's World Banking's proprietary research division. Join me as I speak with changemakers around the globe to deconstruct the social and economic exclusion women face. We'll discover new evidence together and drive action to accelerate women's economic empowerment. Because a leg up isn't a handout, it's a global game changer. Hi, everyone. Welcome and thank you so much for tuning in to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast, streaming on LinkedIn. I'm your host, Sonia Kelly. If you are listening on LinkedIn Live, you'll be seeing Women's World Banking, me or my colleagues here in the chat. And I'm hoping we're going to be able to have a parallel conversation over there while I talk to our guest. We'll also be sharing some additional insights and resources in the chat as we go along. So don't change your browser because you might miss some things that pop up there. Before we get started, I'd like to give a special shout out to Women's World Banking's Making Finance Work for Women sponsors. Our leading sponsor is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Our scaling sponsor is Ernst & Young. Our broadening sponsors are the MetLife Foundation and the European Investment Bank. And our supporting sponsors are the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, the United Nations Capital Development Fund, and the International Finance Corporation. We're also incredibly grateful to our core funders for enabling our strategy, including Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, the Visa Foundation, and you all. I extended an invitation last time saying that you could join our list of sponsors by going to our website, which is, it's very easy, www.womensworldbanking.org, and making a contribution there too. And we saw some of you giving, and I'm just so grateful. I love that we get to share these insights, and I love that you all are participating. Today, we're going to be discussing the importance of physical touch points in a digital world, recognizing women's preferences to continue to get help when they need it and have an outlet for redress, or to have a person to talk to when they're making big decisions about their financial lives, even as they adopt to digital financial services. And we're going to talk about some of the ecosystem and policy and supervisory implications of this shift to digital while also maintaining physical touch points. It's a complicated topic, but we made up a name, or I don't know if we made it up or if someone else made it up, but there's this word that we're going to be using throughout that's a combination of physical and digital. We're going to be using called phygital. So we're going to put a little note here across the bottom of the screen to note that physical and digital together means phygital. And we're going to be saying that throughout just so you're aware of our terms. So as per usual, I'll start with a brief introduction to this topic, and then I'll introduce our guest and we'll have a conversation about it that I'm really looking forward to. And so here's the intro. If you're just getting up to speed on this, if this is new for you, we have seen a rapid transformation towards digital financial solutions in the last decade, two decades working in this space. But we've also seen that this rapid transformation towards digital financial solutions might be leaving behind low-income women who don't have convenient or reliable access to digital offerings. And digital offerings might mean a handheld digital device, like a personal technology device, or it might mean connectivity to the internet? Like, even if they have a device, is it connected? Or is the device sufficient? In fact, GSMA, that's the Global Mobile Association, their latest research notes a stall in progress in closing the gender gap in mobile phone ownership and usage. The gap was closing over time before. We actually saw that COVID accelerated the closure of the gap as women needed to use personal technology devices to engage with the world during lockdowns. But we've seen that progress stalled. As of 2021, for example, GSMA reported that women in sub-Saharan African countries were less likely to than men to own a mobile phone and less likely to use mobile internet when they did own a phone by 37% in both scenarios. So a 37% gap in phone ownership or mobile internet usage, leaving 192 million women in this region alone without mobile internet. For many low-income women customers, engaging regularly with financial institutions and their products and their channels can be kind of intimidating as well. So it's not just access to personal technology, but also financial and digital capability to be able to use that technology for financial services. General financial literacy programs might not be effective at this digital financial capability piece and might be overwhelming as well. Like it's a lot. It's a lot to digest. And so how can financial services providers leverage both in-person and digital solutions to provide targeted financial capability building so that women get the information that they need when they need it in order to engage digitally and that they have ways to engage physically when they can't engage digitally? We also know that there are key moments in a woman's use of financial services, like when they sign up for an account or when they choose a loan product or when they conduct a first transaction. And these moments are critical to building women consumers' confidence and trust. And benefits might be lost when those moments are conducted only digitally. Women's World Banking research shows that there are certain physical touch points, like working with women banking agents, for example, which can help build trust between women customers and the financial services institutions that they're using. As well, in many emerging economies, it makes sense to maintain physical touch points and more traditional solutions together with digital so that when women customers are at particular moments of frustration or when there is fraud or when they have a complaint, they know where to go and they're not just trying to press one if they have a problem or press two, like not just engaging in digital, but actually those customer redress mechanisms are there for them when they feel like they need to reach out to someone. I also just before I talk to our guest here, I just want to share a story of a woman that I recently engaged with in Indonesia. She's a recipient of government-to-person payments through this social protection program in Indonesia called the Pkh program, administered by the Ministry of Social Affairs. This program actually covers 13 million people in Indonesia. And she gets government-to-person payments through a bank that has a contract with the government. Now, this contract actually changes regularly. She lives in a rural area. And so when she first started getting the payments, she would go to the agent of the bank that's a few kilometers away from her house. This is the one agent that serves the entire community. This agent is an agent of only that bank that distributes government-to-person payments. And so she goes and takes her payment out. That bank, though, that she's getting payments through actually has a mobile app, which is really exciting. And so she was able to take out her phone and show us a mobile app that she engages with sometimes when she can get Wi-Fi connection with her phone. However, this is so interesting. In this particular community, there is only this one banking agent. And when the contract changes from one financial services provider to another in terms of the administration of the payments, the agent switches from being an agent of one bank to being an agent of another bank. So for this woman, that customer agent relationship is kind of the most important part of her financial services life. Like she gets that payment out from going to the banking agent, whoever that banking agent represents. If she's feeling brave, she can download the app from the other financial institution on her phone and use the account through a mobile wallet or an internet-enabled wallet through the banking app on her phone. But that agent continues to be a critical financial services connection point for her, especially since she needs the cash for her everyday life. As Women's World Banking works with women like this, we're thinking about all of these things, the geographic relationship between her and her home and where the agent is, how she's using digital financial services and how it all works together for her benefit, so that we can say things like, have you considered leaving a little bit of money in your account and saving a little bit for a rainy day, or if there's a business opportunity, or for if your child gets sick? And we can talk about like how to best activate her further use of financial services, recognizing that government-to-person payments can be an on-ramp to financial inclusion. But that kind of work isn't possible with digital-only touchpoints. It's also not terribly interesting without the digital touchpoints, too. And so that's why we're going to be talking about the digital revolution here today. So enough from me. That's enough of a preamble. I'd like now to welcome our guest, Simone De Castri. So he'll come on the screen with me here. He's the co-head and co-founder of the Cambridge Soup Tech Lab. And I'd like to hear about that in just a minute. But first, let me just say some nice things about Simone, because I've known you now for like quite some time. Let's just not say how long. It would give away our age. But Simone is so interesting to me because he's been at some of the critically important organizations working on payments, telecommunications, technology. Like he's been at the forefront of this digital revolution. He's worked with both C-suite executives and central bank governors on these questions, but he's also a really thoughtful participant in the financial inclusion and digital transformation space. So what I appreciate about Simone and why I've asked him to join us here today is that he doesn't do digital for the sake of digital. He does digital to solve real world problems, and he does digital when it works to solve those problems. And when it doesn't work, he's not going to recommend digital financial services. He has a PhD. What else can I say about you? He's just a really good person to know. With that non-traditional intro, I mean, if you can click on his bio here and go to his LinkedIn page if you want to read more about him. But like that's the important stuff for this conversation. With that preamble and introduction, welcome, Simone. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you so much, Sonia. Hi, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving.
That's right. It is actually Thanksgiving here in the U.S., but you know, only in the U.S. and much of our audience is outside of the U.S., so that's why we're continuing to maintain this release on Thursday mornings. Simone, I like to start by asking our guests about their origin story. So could you share your journey to where you are now at Cambridge University, focusing on supervisory technology, which is like a new area, but your journey has been kind of wandery through this digital financial services space. So I'd love for you to share a little bit about some highlights on that journey and how financial inclusion fits into all of it.
Thank you so much for the question, Sonia. I mean, when you ask me this question, I really go back to my memories as a child. My parents were over indebted. Finance was an issue. The challenges of the formal financial sector, of accessing credit, of being under the pressure of paying back, were something that we were discussing every day. It was part of our life for a certain number of years. So I do remember the tension. I do remember the challenges. And my mom was a small entrepreneur. She had for 30 years a small shop in our town with two other women. So there were three women in business together for 35 years. Not always successful. And so there was another type of conversation, accessing to credit from a bank and the challenges as a group of three women to be able to receive credit from banks, which is something they were not always successful in getting when they were in business. So somehow my experience was, since I was very young, about how important is formal finance in the life and also informal finance, because, you know, when there are some conversations, there are also questions that come to the table, where to get the money from. And so how important is in the life of an household? That's where I grew up and where I come from. And when I studied law, I decided to study law, regulation, and finance, and to possibly dedicate my professional life to resolve, discuss some of these big questions that come when we start thinking about how financial sectors can really help resiliency, financial, economic, and social inclusiveness. How the financial sector can help to build more transparent economies, fighting money laundering, supporting sustainability and climate action. So these are all incredibly important questions for us as humans in these times. And I'm really grateful that I have been able to spend the last 20 years with incredible colleagues, people super dedicated all around the world to try to address some of these questions. My trajectory has been to work, starting to work in microfinance. You know, it was 20 years ago. So we really got inspired educated through the first wave of microcredit, then microfinance. Then we started working on digital financial services. I was really, really lucky to join the mobile money movement somehow at the very beginning, and to work for an incredible group team like the Mobile Money for the Unbanked team at the GSMA back in the days. And we were really like trying to create this bespoke dialogue between technologists, private sector, policymakers, regulators, to create new windows for innovation. So that's where my career started to be at the intersection of finance, tech, and public policy, the technology element, the digital elements, that then became primary, where I started to work on supervisory technologies about 7 years ago, because I myself felt the shift and the questions rising about supporting financial inclusion, supporting access and usage for millions of people all around the world. But then what? Who is out there to make sure that these people are not abused, that these people have access to a financial, formal financial sector that is responsible, that is actually responding when there are requests for recourse and redress, that is not discriminating against certain groups. Women are one of those groups, and we will talk probably about that. That is offering solutions to make sure that this financial sector is really serving its purpose. And so that's been how I came to SupTech, working on the RegTech for Regulators Accelerator first, and then being able to bring R2A into the University of Cambridge with the Cambridge SupTech Lab.
That's right. And R2A is the RegTech to Regulators Accelerator program. Okay, you said a couple things I wanted to pick up on. One was the importance of supervisors. Actually, before you moved into the supervisory space, I wasn't hearing any financial inclusion people talking about supervision. Like, we heard a lot about policy, we heard a lot about regulation, but not about supervision. I'm really aware, though, that our audience might not know the differences between those things, policymakers, regulators, and supervisors. So I wonder if you could just, if we could define our terms here and you could tell me what supervisors are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, you know, the plumber, the electrician, and the person who installs your windows in the house. Within a central bank, within a securities commission, a financial authority, which mission is to maintain the stability, the soundness, the integrity of the financial sector, sometimes also to promote inclusion and to promote consumer protection, depending on their mandate. A mandate that is expanding, so more and more work, more responsibilities for these people who are the watchdogs of the financial sector. Within these agencies, there are people who are dedicated to policy making, so issuing policies. They are somehow providing guidance where the financial sector is going. Some that are relevant to this conversation can be, for example, guidance has been issued policies on the digitization of financial services. So what is this vision of a digital society where financial services are digital, where people start using mostly digital channels? So how do we integrate the channels, the mobile phones, the networks that need to be available, the type of products that are available. And now, okay, people start making transfers and payments with mobile money, saving money in there. Can we connect government payments into that? That's part of the policy vision, which is transferred into regulation, because then we need to understand what are the rules of the game for the private sector to be able to offer those services. And so through regulation, hopefully, regulators are able to open windows for innovation to advance and also to direct the private sector towards specific goals and make sure that there is a certain market conduct that is responsible. So also putting boundaries around the way of doing business for banks, for credit card issuers, for payments providers, brokers, and all the different providers in the financial sectors. But then who is going to verify that this is actually happening? Who is going to check that everybody is doing their job within these regulatory boundaries? That's the role of the financial supervisors. So financial supervisors really are there to keep on check the financial service providers to make sure that if the customers are experiencing problems, challenges, they have recourse. And these are not disconnected. Well, actually, they are disconnected functions, unfortunately, but they should be not. This should be a virtuous cycle of intelligence, of data that circulates so that supervision informs policy and regulation. And then there are also other important jobs within these agencies, statisticians, researchers, but let's keep it to these three for now.
Yeah, that's great. That was really helpful. Okay, so getting to digital financial services, this is our theme for the day. We're talking about this interplay between digital and physical. You have been a person at the forefront of the digital revolution. You have a vision for what the world is going to look like probably in like 20 years, thinking about where we're going to be and what, you know, what we're going to be used. But in the meantime, we're in this disequilibrium where we've got physical and digital services or physical and digital elements of services working together. Can you, when you think about that working together, that interplay, can you give me an example of a product that comes to mind for you and tell us kind of how it works? What parts have to remain physical for now? What parts can move digital and kind of how you see that working from a customer perspective? And then we'll talk about the supervisory perspective in a minute too.
Yes, I mean, and I think when we think about financial inclusion and the experience of women, we can talk, for example, about mobile money. You know, mobile money is it's a payment and storage product. So people use it to transfer money, to make payments, also sometimes to keep a balance in that account. And that account is through mobile phones. So there is a digital element for sure. But still, we do need cash in and cash out points where people can load money into their accounts and can withdraw when they want the cash to go back into physical form into their hands. So that's a typical one where we see this coexistence of the physical and the digital world in a product that has been revolutionary for the life of millions of people in emerging countries. And it's a product that we, for example, in the United States, we don't have because it's able to act outside of the banking system. People don't need to have a bank account to be able to have a mobile money account, even if the banks act in the background, keeping the float, so the more technical consideration. So there is a safety there. It's not outside of the formal banking system, but is alternative at least to the formal banking system. And the connection between physical and digital, it's very complex today. If we think about, for example, alternative credit scoring, not so many elements of a personal history or person that can go into being taken into account on evaluating a person, an individual worthiness of credit. That's also where we have a lot of now with alternative data, real life, physical life being brought into digital algorithms to access digital credit. So we see this intersection more and more because digital is new and is becoming, is at a tipping point where it's becoming probably part of the majority of the usage for many people around the world for financial services. But we're still, the physicality is an integral part of the user experience.
That's totally true. And I didn't think about that element of having to move physical data or physical patterns into, or having to digitize physical things as part of that digital piece. Like I was just thinking channels and technology, but not data. And that's so true. That's so true.
I can give you for one example in the world of supervision, for example, where the people who are in the board of banks, of many financial entities, goes through some checks from the supervisor to make sure that these people, for example, are not being convicted for financial frauds. So to sit in a board of a bank, you need to have a certain conduct. Part of that check, in many cases, is checking fingerprints to check the records. In the state of New York, those fingerprints are taken digitally, but then the digital data is printed on paper because the applications are filed on paper to then report them in digital in answering to the applications. So this is just an example, but that's where we live in. We live in a world where all these, the challenge of many of these processes that need to be digitized, it's around the continuous transfer from physical to digital, digital to physical of this data, which creates redundancies, which creates opportunities for mistakes, for duplications. And we see this across our life as citizens, and we see this in the financial authorities, we see this in the financial institutions. What we need to do is to really mainstream these processes so to create opportunities for cost savings, facilitating like time, acceleration, speed, and get to customers with better services, lower costs, products, and a better experience.
Yeah, so you just started moving us into the supervisory direction, and I want to keep going in that direction. Is there a learning curve for supervisors too in this digital revolution? I mean, it's a learning curve for customers no matter what. They need digital financial capability. They need to practice. And I talked about that at the beginning. But when it comes to supervisors, what are the kinds of things that you're doing with supervisors to make sure that they have the knowledge and skills they need in this very quickly changing world?
Yeah, I mean, the world of supervision is really under a lot of pressure because the market is becoming global, datafied. That's what we talk about now. There's so many new data created by the financial institutions, by the consumers, just using digital devices, digital accounts, digital assets. And very complex, you know, all the new fragmentation of financial services that change in terms of intermediary, who is really my counterpart as a financial, when I pay with Stripe, with my credit card, am I dealing with Stripe? Am I dealing with MasterCard? Am I dealing just with the vendor, who's the guy who is giving my cafe? We don't know anymore. And on the side of the supervisor, there are the same questions, no? With all the unbundling of financial services and this complexity in the market. So there is a market that is changing at a very fast pace. Public agencies, public sector, with all the legacies, all the challenges of the public sector, all the constraints in transforming, for example, hiring, giving competitive salaries, even giving training sometimes, procuring new technology solutions. So these agencies that look outside of the window where the society is running very fast, the customers are expecting a certain quality and a certain experience also from governments these days. And that's the right expectation. On the other side, we have agencies that are unfortunately still stuck working with legacy system, legacy culture, siloed processes and data sets. I do diagnostics, I work with them. I found some financial authorities, they are still all using Lotus Note to as a file sharing and custodian system. The last update on Lotus Note has been 20 years ago. We still see incredibly important data sets that are transmitted just over email with incredible risks from the point of view of lack of encryption, cybersecurity. These are financial agencies, institution data, these are customer data. This is super important, but also the capacity to run algorithms on Excel is very limited. Like think of anti-money laundering supervisors who are catching the criminals who are using the financial sector to launder money that they've made through the worst crimes, really the worst things. And the financial sector is pretty open to that, will come in the money. I can just share one data that I like to share because really signals the emergency for this transformation. About 5% of the global GDP, we're talking about trillions of dollars, is laundered through the formal financial sector every year. And only 1% is caught by the authorities. We're talking about really the financial sector is open to criminals to use the money, the prevent of prostitution, pedophily, drug trafficking, corruption. The money is in our economy. There's no gate that closes there. So we do need to intervene and to change things. And this is important also for changing the experience of women in the financial services. For example, working on algorithmic biases, making sure that, as we said before, the credit scoring algorithms do not discriminate against women. And we know, we have data for sure, that this is happening. So how do we empower the supervisor to check those algorithms, to make sure that the human biases are not brought and perpetuated and multiplied by artificial intelligence? So these are incredible, important ethical questions that we need to face. When we talk about, as we say, the alternative credit scoring. And so for a woman, it's very important to be able to bring a credit history that is not the traditional one, because the traditional one was not there. And so other data that can help a woman to access to credit, whether as an individual or for a business or for a household. How do we make sure that when things go wrong, a woman has access to recourse and redress? That's where we see the success of experiences like the chatbot in the Philippines and in so many countries now. So these are very, very key questions that we need to address if we want to build a truly inclusive financial sector that serves everyone. And we need to look deep into the gender, the disaggregation of data by sex, to be able to understand what are the real, what is the real experience of women using financial services. We know that there is a gap. There is a big gap in access to financial services and in usage of financial services. Why is this gap still there, even if so much efforts are put in place to address it? We need to look into the data, and most of the data are in the public agencies that are supervising the financial sector, because they receive this data from the private sector, they receive this data through complaints mechanisms. So if we want to understand more about the financial journey of women, we need to look at those data, disaggregate them by sex, understanding what is there in terms of behaviors, both by the private sector, the financial institutions, and the women who are using financial services. And that's also something that affects, I mean, it's not just a matter of doing it in the supervisory agencies. We need to look at the legal frameworks that are in place. I think we have about 130 countries that still lack a solid legal protection against gender discrimination in access to credit. This is very important. I mean, even recently, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in the US had lost a lawsuit indicating that their mandate over discriminatory practices is pretty limited. So there is definitely a level of technicality and specificity where we need to bring this conversation about making finance work for women also on the side of the public agencies that regulate and supervise the financial services.
Our conversation has gone in a different direction than I expected it to, which I always love when that happens. It's so serendipitous because I want to point out for our audience that the direction we went and why it's important. So when I sent you like the list of questions that I was going to draw from. And one thing that I just assumed was that we were going to be talking about the risks of exclusion that come from digital financial services and the risk of moving too quickly into digital financial services, dropping physical touch points, and therefore excluding people. You have just kind of blown my mind and flipped the script because you just said, there's a huge risk of exclusion by not moving quickly enough into digital financial services when it comes to supervisory techniques. So like chatbots, for example. Chatbots are fantastic for being able to analyze complaints that are coming in. So if there are so many people writing into the chatbot or like contacting some kind of interactive voice response, mobile phone number or something, they call leave a message. If there's a huge number of people who are saying, this one bank in this area keeps charging me fees and I tell them not to, the supervisor with technology and digitization can pick up on that and say, that's not inclusive. Like this bank is letting a rural branch do this thing. And they can like really hyper target gender and location and other attributes of callers. And so I think that's something that's really critically important as we think about the phygital revolution and also a big learning curve for supervisors. So I'm really glad that you brought that thing up. Before I ask the next question, see your face and I want to let you respond.
Thinking of an example of your conversation with the woman in Indonesia, you know, of the agent that serves two different providers. Now, let's say one provider creates some good incentives for that agent to be primary one provider agent. So the people who are interacting with the agents suddenly see a switch. It's trying probably to sell something else, something different to make a bigger margin. If there is charging more, if there is somehow hiding something, hiding some fees. These people could, if the chatbot like the one in the Philippines is in place, start conversing with the central bank. And of course, one, nothing. But if it's 5, 6, 7, if it's an unnatural pattern of complaints, they should alert the supervisor in a place that is rural and where probably if there is not an access through the supervisor through a mobile phone, there's not a central bank branch in a rural area. There's not probably internet laptop to go into the website of the central bank and file a system. So the important thing is that also these technologies need to be built with inclusivity in our mind. So when we were in the Philippines 6 years ago, working with the incredible team of the Banco Central of the Philippines, we didn't build a chatbot that was working on your smartphones. We built a chatbot that provided exactly the same type of assistance on a flip phone, on a 20 years old Nokia text message, SMS. It works. The level of support the person can receive is the same. That's very, very important that we also on the government side look at these technologies and we build them to be inclusive. And the other thing, Sonia, I also wanted to make sure I don't push the hype of digital. Not everything needs to be digital. The real life is still there. And this is particularly important, I believe, for the aging population. We cannot leave behind millions of people for whom this shift is too fast. We need to continue to make sure that everybody can get the benefits of modernization and so continuing to translate, continuing to educate, and really making sure that we build inclusive economies and inclusive societies. So just want to make sure that I am excited about the possibilities of digital, particularly on the government side. I think it's absolutely fundamental, the digital transformation of public agencies, from tax agencies to central banks. There is way too many costs and not much effectiveness in government and in the public sector. But when we go into the client, the retail level, physical still has a big role to play, I believe.
That's a great reminder and a great statement. I want to ask one more substantive question, and then I'm going to ask you for a leave behind for our audience. The substantive question is on women supervisors. I'd love to hear what your experience is when it comes to empowering women supervisors. It's actually something I know very little about, but something Women's World Banking cares deeply about is making sure there are women in decision-making positions. And so I wonder if you could just kind of educate me on what the landscape is for women supervisors.
I love this question because I love to work with so many female colleagues in supervisory agencies. There are women who are very at the top of many public agencies. I mean, the former governor of the Central Bank of Malaysia, for example, has been really a leader of financial inclusion. Maya Bulnaga, the deputy governor of the Central Bank of Egypt, the former deputy governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, current deputy governor of the National Bank of Rwanda. They're all women who are incredibly expert, passionate, collaborative. They are really, really amazing. And we're working with them. If you don't mind doing a little bit of a short commercial, but on Thursday, December 7th, we will host as part of SupTech Week, which is an online event dedicated to financial supervision and the digitization of financial supervision, one roundtable on gender disaggregated data with some of these women will come together to reflect on how we can advance this data science agenda to look into the gender gap. There are incredible colleagues. What we're trying to do to support their career is offering scholarships for them to take advantage of the educational programs that we offer at Cambridge. We have just launched a program called Innovation Leaders in Residency, where our goal is to help all supervisors, and there will be a focus, 3 out of the 5 scholarships will be given to women, to be able to gain an international profile, have an international experience, speaking in conferences, have support from our team to do research without leaving their central banks. Because what we see is a lot of supervisor people in public agencies migrating to international agencies because, of course, like the opportunities are offered. What we want to incentivize them to do is to stay where they are, to make a change, be the agents of transformation, and for us to go there and support them. I have to say that I'm pretty proud that in the first 2 years of the lab, across all the spectrum of the services that we offer, we haven't yet achieved the 50-50 balance in terms of gender, but we're very close and we are very intentional in doing so. And I believe that right now, 75% to 80% of the team of the Cambridge SupTech Lab, data scientists, technologists, product managers, they are women that we work with.
That is awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Congratulations. That's huge. You mentioned the December 7th event, so that's something to take note of. And can people go to your website and sign up for the December 7th event?
Absolutely. There is a website that we created for this forum, suptechweek.org, where everybody can register. Everybody is welcome to join the different sessions. The one on gender, the forum runs for December 4th to December 7th, and this roundtable on gender is on December 7th.
And I'm looking forward to it. I saw that email from you. I also wanted to ask the last question. This, I call this the leave behind question. What do you want to leave behind for our audience here? Is there anything you're particularly excited about coming up, not just in the next few weeks, but in the next couple of years? Everybody could watch this space, or any word that you want to leave with our audience here at the end?
Oof. Yes. It's a call for action to men to take seriously every issue that it's about gender. And we're talking about gender and financial services. In Italy right now, which is the country where I come from, there is a big debate about women's safety and domestic violence. Men need to start take action. Men need to start looking at these issues and not as not problems of women. These are problems that we have created. These are problems that we are responsible to resolve. So that's my legacy from this conversation.
That's wonderful. Simone, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And enjoy your Thanksgiving.
Thank you so much, Sonia. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
Just a couple reflections from that conversation. I mean, wow, that was such a great one. One thing Simone mentioned was in his career journey, he talked about this theme of creating windows for innovation. And throughout our conversation, I kept thinking about that, about how we can create windows for innovation that are also inclusive, and that requires so much thoughtfulness. Like I said at the beginning, it's not just digital for the sake of digital, but digital for the sake of solving problems and thinking about the physical touch points or the adaptations that need to be there for customers who don't have a smartphone or older customers who might just like never be comfortable with a huge rise in digital technology. He also talked about the datafied nature of the world, but the fact that datafied doesn't actually mean neat and tidy and useful, and there's so much that needs to be done there. And then finally, we made some assumptions at the beginning about the importance of digital financial services to not move so quickly that women who don't have those digital capabilities, that they're not left behind. But Simone also has the supervisory perspective in mind, thinking about the risks of not using digital tools for supervision and how that might create new lines of exclusion if we're not using digital tools for the complex analysis that they're capable of. And those are the things I'm taking away from this conversation. A couple calls to action for you all. You know I like to end with calls to action. One is, it's just so important that women be at the table. Investing in women leaders within regulatory and supervisory and policymaking bodies, reshaping that landscape of government officials and propelling women's financial inclusion forward is so critically important to making sure that women's voices are heard. And also for men in those positions, you need to be thinking about gender as an important and cross-cutting and critical and emergency issue. And Simone gave us that call to action at the end. And then second, in your market, whatever your role is in the financial sector, take a look at your national financial inclusion strategy, which actually most countries have at this point. It's so remarkable, the progress we've made in the last 15 years. So take a look at your national financial inclusion strategy. Are there measurable mandates specifically around women? If there are, how are they planning on being achieved? Are there ways that financial services providers can help the government achieve their targets by focusing on the felt needs of women customers, of the end users of products? And if you don't know where to start, you can give us at Women's World Banking a call. Go to our website, slide into our DMs and contact us. We'd be happy to engage with you. And then finally, mark your calendar for our next podcast release in December, where we'll be back with another episode on the third Thursday of the month. If you're going to be traveling for the holidays coming up here in the next month, our December episode will keep you company, and it's definitely one you won't want to miss. I'm going to be joined with another distinguished guest to reflect on the past year and explore the top 10 drivers of women's financial inclusion that we observed in 2023. It was really a big year, I think, coming out of COVID, coming out of some of the patterns we established then and new innovation. There's so much we're going to be talking about next month. And this is all in the name of making finance work for women, as you know. So thank you again for joining us. Looking forward to next time.